This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Studio in beautiful Clearwater, Florida. The perfect place for writers to write and for readers to enjoy a great book. At the bottom of the hour, I will be interviewing Brian James, who has written a humorous and touching trilogy about his father. Brian has done what I suggest all of you do. Write something. Don't let those memories fade away. Just sit down and start writing. And Brian has done an amazing job. Not only that, he's also created a writer's platform that is really so interesting. And the way he finds readers is amazing. So I'm very anxious to talk to him at the bottom of the hour. But meanwhile, I have in the studio with me Bill Larson, who is of Larson & Larson. Now, this is a law firm that I can recommend because they are my lawyers, and I believe in having a great lawyer. So I want to thank you, Bill, for joining me in the studio today. Hi.
Hello.
Great. Well, you know, of course, we're going to be talking about intellectual property rights and all of the things that writers need to know about the law. But first, let's hear something about Larson & Larson and about what you do.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me today. I started the firm about 29 years ago with my father, Herb, who has since passed. And Herb wrote the patents, and I answered the phone, and that's how we got going. And here we are 29 years later. We have four wonderful attorneys working with us and great support staff, and we specialize in intellectual property. So we help people with patents, trademarks, copyrights, licensing issues, and, of course, litigation.
Okay, well, that takes in a whole big ball game here. When we talk specifically about writers, you know, I have talked to so many best-selling authors, and of course they all have have horror stories about not protecting some of their rights. And I was recently talking to a very New York Times best-selling author, and she said to me, "Oh, it's wonderful to have an agent who gets you a deal for big bucks, and you're so happy, and you're already imagining all the things you're going to do with it. But if you don't have a good lawyer who can make sure that you actually see it at the end of the deal, you're in trouble." So I'm so happy that you're here today, and we'll talk a little bit about you know, whatever ideas you have on intellectual properties that writers should know about. Of course, one of the biggest things, and this is a question I was asked at a recent writers conference here, how can you use a person's name in a book, a public person? How far can you go? What can you say about them and not get yourself in trouble?
All right, well, that's a very important part of the law. And we basically divide folks up into two categories, those in the public and those in the private. Private people you can say very little about unless it's truthful, sort of like news. But public people, you can pretty much say anything you want. And if you take a look at the tabloids, for instance, you see the terrible things they say about the president or actors and actresses. There's really no limit to what you can say. So once you enter the public realm, then you are pretty much free game for the author to comment.
Well, I was reading, an author gave me a book to read. She hasn't published it yet, so that's one of the reasons I think she wanted to ask this question. Now, in this book, her characters are attending a concert, and more sort of a concert and a speaker, a famous comedian, and the famous comedian was telling jokes, and now her characters in the book are commenting on this man's jokes. And now, he is a very famous man, and actually the concert was actually very real, and they were very lame jokes, and so she has her characters making fun of him quite It's quite amusing. I mean, it's a very amusing scene. She had lots of fun writing it because she really got the whole idea correct, I think, about people in the audience are watching a comedian and their jokes are not anything near as good as they are on television when they're trying to ad lib. So she's rather scathing. I mean, it's really, some of the things they say about him are pretty awful. Now, is she in trouble?
Not necessarily, no. That's permissible speech. Now, remember, we believe in free speech in this country, which means that you're allowed to criticize people. And if you're in the public and you're a public figure or you're an actor or a comedian, you are fair game for criticism.
So she can keep that scene in the book, huh?
Probably, yes.
Okay, and he's not going to come and sue her?
He might.
Oh, great. Well, I said to her, because she really was a little bit worried about it then, I said, well, you know, if this certain comedian on late night television should come after you, I think it'd be great. It'd be wonderful, actually. You'd get a lot of publicity for a book that probably, you know, wouldn't on its own get a lot of publicity. So I'm not sure that it would be so bad in her case, but... It does happen.
And there's a very famous Supreme Court case. Larry Flint, remember, and Jerry Falwell. And Larry Flint set out to just assassinate Jerry Falwell's reputation in every way. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that you can do it. Jerry Falwell was in the public, and he was fair game.
So could say what they wanted. Well, okay, so that opens, for authors, because it is a scary thing when you want to use somebody's name and you sort of think about what should I...
You have to be careful when you're talking about a person who's in the private part of the realm of the United States. So you can't say slanderous things. You can't libel people. You can't say horrible untruths that could damage their reputation. But that's different when you enter the public realm.
Well, if you write a book, for example, you write a book and it's basically in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book about your life, and people can sort of see that it's your story. And you've changed the names of some of your neighbors, but people could still tell which neighbors they are. Are you in trouble?
Probably no.
No?
No.
So if you say something nasty about somebody, it doesn't...
Well, it's whether it's truthful or not.
Oh.
If they're a bad person and you say so, that's okay. If they're a good person and you set out to hurt their reputation, then that's actionable under the law.
Yeah, okay. So that is sort of a gray area then, because you could...
There's always a gray area in the law, yes. There's no black and white.
Oh, that's...
That's why we have lawyers.
That's why we have lawyers, and that's why we need lawyers. So, now, with your experience in intellectual property, have you seen much of this kind of thing happen where people have run into problems?
Yes, but not in the area of authorship. It's usually in the area of products and using somebody's likeness or name or image in a way to sell a product, let's say a candy bar, and that you can't do.
And also having the rights to the illustrations is important. Like if you are working with somebody.
Yes. Illustrations in a book... are usually done not by the author. And the author needs to obtain the rights in those drawings from the artist. And they can only be transferred. The ownership can only be transferred. The copyright can only be transferred if it's in writing. And this is the biggest problem we see with authors. They hire an artist to create drawings for the book. The author does not get it in writing. The copyright is not transferred. And later on, if there's a dispute, the author doesn't have the copyright or the right to reproduce those artists' renditions.
And this has happened quite...
This happens over and over and over. And it can be cleaned up very easily in advance with a one-page document with a couple of magic words, a couple of magic copyright words, and the problem's solved.
I have told some children's writers that they have to be very careful about that. As a matter of fact, one woman I met, she is making handmade... She's written a book with puppets. Mm-hmm. Actually, she did the puppets before she did the book. She did the puppets for her grandchildren, very hand puppets, very cute characters. And then because her grandchildren started to grow up and didn't want her to play around at the dinner table with her hand puppets all the time, she decided she would save the stories and write a book about it. So she's written a book. Well, she's written a couple of books now with the hand puppets. And now in her case, she's done something sort of clever because she didn't have money to hire an illustrator. She has actually taken photos of her hand puppets. But so she's using that to illustrate her books. Now, of course, now she's started thinking, if they become popular, can somebody go ahead and make copies of her hand puppets just from looking at the picture?
And the answer is no, they can't, if you protect your copyright properly. So the text that authors write, the drawings that authors create, or the photographs that people take are all protected by copyright, all three of them. And copyright is afforded to the artist or the photographer or the author immediately upon creation. So you get that right automatically. But there's a second step, and that's the registration process. You have to file a document with the federal government, with the Copyright Office, pay your fee, and get it registered. Once it's registered, you can protect it. And that is the step that a lot of artists and authors don't take. They don't get the copyright registered with the Library of Congress.
And it gets a little bit more involved, especially when you're merchandising things, that you really have to be careful because as she's now worried that people like her things and they can just go ahead and make
and
these
they will.
Hand puppets.
They will. If it's popular, they'll copy it.
Yes. As a matter of fact, and she was planning, she was thinking about sending the book to be done overseas by, you know, there are publishers overseas who do books, but they also steal things, I think.
Right. And the first indication that you have something valuable is there's piracy. Because they're not going to steal it, and they're not going to reproduce it if it doesn't have value.
Yeah. So, so there's a lot of things that one has to think about when one is an author, and about protecting your rights.
You need to have a strategy up front. So you need to see a lawyer. And I understand a lot of authors and artists don't have an enormous amount of money to spend on attorneys, but it's really not a fortune that you need to spend up front to get a couple of documents prepared and have a strategy to protect yourself.
Exactly, because you never know. I mean, it's amazing. I know, for example, a certain woman who wrote a book called Shades of Grey never expected it to turn out to be such a bestseller, even in her wildest dreams. And, of course, she faced all sorts of...
enormous amount of litigation.
Lots of litigation. And so it would have been behooved her to have done everything up front.
See a copyright attorney, get some basic advice, get those documents that you need, those contracts in advance, and get them signed as you're going through your business, and protect yourself downstream.
Because along the way, you will be dealing with... A lot of writers think that an agent will do this. Literary agents do not protect your rights. That's not their job. Their job is to sell and to find you a publisher, but it's up to the author to protect rights.
Agents and lawyers work hand in hand to protect the author or the artist, correct?
But
the agent, no. The agent typically is not an attorney and is not going to protect those rights. They have a different function.
Exactly. And so that's why it's important for authors to know what the difference is.
See a lawyer, get a little bit of advice.
That
will go a long way, I
promise.
Oh,
yes, I can tell you that from experience. It goes a long way. I'm going to do one program one day about all of... No, I'm going to actually do a movie. I think I'll do a script about all the lawyers that I've dealt with over the years. And the reason I love you is that I think you have such a great attitude toward... you know, really protecting authors, and that's important. And of course, protecting inventors, too. And
that's my job every day.
And that's your job.
I protect inventors. I protect authors and artists.
And that's such a rewarding job, to be able to know that you're doing that.
So, you meet so many fantastic people and talented people.
Oh, it is true. It's like on this program, I get to meet all these talented and wonderful writers. And, of course, it's just... a thrill for me to talk to all these creative people and to see how their minds work and what's motivated them. And now for you, of course, I assume anybody who goes into this business of creative and entertainment law and intellectual property law is interested in books and likes to read. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I read for a living. That's what I do.
That's what you do. So what books are you particularly fond of? What have influenced you?
Well, in high school, I went to a private high school, and I read all the classics. I loved those novels. But then I went on to, in college, I went on to a science degree, and I switched to nonfiction. And so most of what I read now is scientific journals, legal opinions, scholarly works, National Geographic, Smithsonian type, Nature, and Science. So I'm strictly a nonfiction reader now.
Okay, but you know, one of the things when you have to find yourself some time here to expand your horizons, and I know that one of the things that you should do is read. I recently spoke to Mike Resnick, who combines science and fiction, and that's a wonderful combination. Or as I also interviewed Robin Cook, who does all these medical mysteries, which are fantastic. So there's a lot of things that you can expand your horizons to.
If you insist, I will.
I will because it's so much fun to read, and it's so much fun. As I said, in a little while, we're going to be talking to an author who, when he retired, was looking for something to do, didn't play golf, didn't want to just waste his days, and he sat down and started writing. And you have to admire people like this so much because it is such a wonderful, wonderful thing to share stories, to be able to keep these stories alive. For example, now you said you started in the law business with your father.
Correct.
And you haven't written a book about him yet, huh?
No, I haven't.
But you're going to start. I bet I'm going to influence.
I think you're
going to
make me.
Oh, I think so. I've already, you know, I'm going to inspire Bill, and especially after he listens to my next guest, to start writing these things. To write it down. Keep a record. Every once in a while when you think of a story, to make a note of it and put it down in a journal and keep it, and you'll find someday that you'll just treasure this, because that's one of the things that I've discovered, that you know, when you start thinking, looking back on your life, you say, oh, I wish I had written this down. I wish I had written that down. So it's a wonderful thing if you just start it now. You know, you're still young and you're not going to retire for a long time, but start writing. And, you know, you'll find it's going to be fun. And, of course, I'm sure that at some point we're going to have a nice handbook of entertainment law from you, and that's what I'm going to encourage you to do, because we have to put all of this down and help writers to make sure that they are protected.
You have to understand your rights.
Absolutely.
First, you have to understand your rights before you can have your rights.
That's true. And so I encourage all writers to get out there and not only write, but think of it as business, because it is a business.
Right.
It is. Writing
is a business.
And the
business side is scary. Okay, the authorship oftentimes comes very easily to authors and artists, but the business side is scary, and it's often put off to the future, another day.
Exactly.
And then it's too late.
And then it's too late,
right.
Because so. you're in a courtroom fighting somebody who's stolen something that you know you created.
You don't find out that you lost your rights until they're gone.
Exactly.
That's the problem, and then it's too late.
It is, and the worst thing is when you create something and you know that it's yours, it came from you, from your mind, from your heart, and then to
it's very personal.
It's very personal.
It's a knife in the heart.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
It is, and I've met some authors who have had just terrible experiences, and of course one of the things with when you're writing a book, now of course most people are writing books, but when you're writing books, you never know when it might turn into a movie deal. Mm-hmm. And then you're talking something, you have better have protected yourself real early on before you go into, you know, getting a movie deal for your
That's
book.
Right. Well-written contract.
Oh, then you better have a really great contract to protect yourself. Because and so many, I read a book, and I've had the author on, David Edmonds. He wrote a book called Lily of Peru. And anybody who hasn't read Lily of Peru yet, I highly recommend this book, because it is, well, I can tell you, David has written this book, and it to me, it is a movie. I read it, and I as I'm reading this book, and I'm thinking, whoa. I sometimes I was confused. Am I reading a book or am I watching a movie? It's so well written. And I can see in his future a movie deal for that book. Because, mm-hmm. you know, not every book that it has a potential to be a movie deal.
No.
But in his case, because it is so well written and it is such an interesting story.
You have to reserve those rights in your publishing agreement.
That's right. You have to have... You have to think about the possibility. And, you know, you might think to yourself, oh, I'm dreaming too big. It'll never happen. But you don't know.
I mean, you look at Harry Potter, for instance. Now it's a theme park.
Exactly.
Who would have ever thought when she first started writing that someday it would be a theme park in Orlando?
Exactly. I mean, it is amazing. And as I said, I've met a few authors, children's authors, who have written books that I like their characters very much. Whether they're going to turn out to be Winnie the Pooh, I don't know. But still... It could be, and you never know when a children's book will then turn into an animation, which will then turn into a movie and a big deal. So exactly what you're saying, think you have
preserve
to plan.
Your rights up front, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's the best
thing. That's the best thing you can do. And if you don't know what your rights are, you can't preserve them.
And now, how do people contact you?
At our website, LarsonPatentLaw.com.
And... you offer free consultations?
Yes, give me a call.
Okay, and they call you at
727-546-0660 here in Pinellas County, Florida.
Okay, well, I'm glad everyone heard that. And I highly recommend that you go to Larson & Larson on the internet and contact Bill and get a free consultation. It doesn't cost you anything. But you'll start getting the idea of what you have to do because it is so, so vital to protect your rights. Because, you know, the joy of having something on paper is fantastic, but the joy of seeing the money in the bank is even better. So do protect your rights. And I want to thank Bill so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
And I hope that you'll come in next month. And each month we're going to talk about a specific part of entertainment law. And for anyone who has a question, send it to me at patsy.radio@gmail.com. And next month when Bill is here, I will go through the questions with him and he will answer directly any question you have. So it's patsy.radio@gmail.com with your legal questions and Bill will answer them. And meanwhile, just go to his website, Larson & Larson. Okay? Thank you, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
Really grateful that you came in today. And now we're going for a little break, and we will be back after a few messages.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you a writer? Do you have a great idea for a movie? Want to know how to get started? Then join the Actors, Screenwriters, and Crew Production Group. They meet every month in Clearwater to talk about how to construct a winning script, get your script read by the group, or just join in the fun. Contact Barbara Harrington, the best-selling author of Give Him Back to God, for time and location. She brings her experience as a screenwriter and casting director in such hit films as Cocoon and Absence of Malice to this lively group of film enthusiasts. So call Barbara, 727-572-6345, or email her at bharrington2@tampabay.rr.com. Get inspired, and one day you may hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. Call Barbara for details at 727-572-6345.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Looking for a good book? Whether you want the latest bestseller or a rare book, Haslam's Bookstore at 2025 Central Avenue in downtown St. Petersburg is the place to visit. Haslam's has been in business for over 70 years and is the largest new and used bookstore in Florida with 30,000 square feet. and over 300,000 books, you'll find just the right book for you. Bestsellers, cookbooks, military, history, and so much more. Check out their website, www.haslams.com, to find out about their special events. Remember, Haslam's, one of Florida's true treasures, 2025 Central Avenue in St. Petersburg, and they're open on Sundays from noon to 5.
At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy a lifestyle to fit your needs. From independent living, assisted living, memory care, and skilled nursing. Our exciting independent lifestyle is the perfect combination of freedom, comfort, and security. Enjoy total independence with peace of mind. Our independent lifestyle includes chef-prepared meals in our beautiful waterfront dining room, a continental breakfast, all utilities, including cable and telephone, housekeeping with linen service, scheduled transportation, including trips for shopping, local restaurants, theater, and more. Our activities program is second to none. At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy affordable luxury waterfront senior living with $1 million view. Call today, 727-445-4069, and discover where caring, compassionate service really makes the difference.
You probably think fairs are just rides, animals, and food, right? At the Florida State Fair, you'll get that and so many more ways to discover the fun. See interesting exhibits, arts and crafts, Cracker Country Living History Museum, and concerts from performers like Robert Cray and Colt Ford. You can also explore the taste of the fair, state robotics championships, and a live butterfly experience. There's so much more to explore at the Florida State Fair, now through the 15th. Purchase tickets at the gate or save time online at floridastatefair.com.
Hey, did you know there's a live psychology talk show 3 days a week, Monday, Thursday, and Friday at noon, where you can call in and get free guidance and also learn several different topics relating to ending the stigma on mental health? It's called Moments of Clarity on WTAN 1340 AM. It's with licensed therapist Tiffany Warner, who will try to end the stigma on mental health. But the only way you can do that is to listen to Moments of Clarity 3 days a week, Monday, Thursday, and Friday at noon on WTAN 1340 AM, the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my next guest, Brian James, who has written a humorous trilogy. And the three books are called Headstone, Fortune, and Chase. And he just brought me in Chase, based on the life of his father. And it's the books are amusing. And he's brought me a cup, too. Hi, everybody. My family is watching up north. I'm from northern Michigan. And everybody up there is watching us and all around the town, too. And in Florida. So it's so nice to have you here, Brian. You are exactly what I have been telling people. I was so happy when your son contacted me to invite you on the program, because one of the things I have been telling people is that they should write their memories and don't let these things be lost, because it is so important. Now, your father, of course, was a character, maybe a more of a character than a lot of our fathers, but every father and every family has somebody interesting in their background, and your father certainly was. So let's talk. Hi, Brian. So say hi to everybody.
All right. Hello, everybody, and thank you very much, Patsy, for the invitation and the opportunity to talk about the book.
Okay. Well, great. Well, you know, of course, the first book is called Headstone, which is, I had not ever been to to the Bunker Hill monument, and it was so funny. You mentioned that right in the beginning of the book, and I always know it's so wonderful. The wonderful thing about the internet is that you can actually go and look at it. So I went and looked at it, and so I could imagine it in my, because the way you write, it was so funny about your father. So let's talk about your father. He was called?
Oh, he's called Junior.
He was called Junior, and he was quite a character, huh?
Well, yeah, he was born in 1915 and grew up, came into the workforce anyway during the middle of the Depression, And he did what he had to do to survive, which included a lot of gambling, a lot of imbibing. And but he was, you know, he was my dad, and he passed away in 84. And I think a key point is that had I written the book in 84, it would have been three times as big. But you forget, and there's no one to even go to rekindle the memories, because his peer group and so forth, my older relatives, they're gone too. So you waste a lot of time by not doing things immediately.
Well, that's why I told Bill Nelson that, because that's exactly what I'm saying. Bill Nelson worked with his father, a lawyer, but again, like most people, he didn't think, hasn't thought to write all this down. And just write it down and write these stories down, and you never know, you know, when you'll have time. It might not be till you retire, but write it down and you have those notes and you have those stories.
Yeah. Well, I initially made some notes for my two younger boys who were 2 and 6 when my dad died, so they didn't know him. My older boy, Jay, is, you know, my press agent now, and he had a strong recollection of his grandfather, but the little boys didn't, and I made some notes, and actually I attended a writing class in Safety Harbor, and I read the notes aloud, and people were falling off the table, you know, saying this is a good start for a book, and you know, I was mesmerized. I said, "Are you kidding?" You know, I just made the notes for the kids, you know, to just give them something, and one thing led to another, and you know, I eventually had some good advice from a lot of people, and I put together the book. And after I put together the first book, we went into a story. The first book is 85% true, and probably 15% Irish. and when I get through with it, I mentioned a bank vault heist, which my father was not involved in, but sure enough, he knew some of the participants, shall we say. And I mentioned that in the book, and people read the book and came up to me at the fairs. We're snowbirds, so we're on the Cape, and we're here in the winter. And they said, what happened to the stuff from the bank vault burglary? And I said, well, I told you at the beginning of the book there was a 15%, you know, fictional factor to it. Oh, no, no. They said, we knew your dad. Come on, what happened to the stuff? So that necessitated the second book, Fortune. After I wrote the second book, Fortune, people came up and said, you know, you mentioned the mob in your book, and you also mentioned the Bureau. You go to Florida in the wintertime? And I said, yeah, I do. And they said, maybe you should go a little earlier this year. And that became Chase.
So, well, you have really captured, I think, the tone of sort of the on the fringe of the mob life.
Yeah.
So now your father, of course, was a big gambler.
Yeah, he was a gambler, but like most gamblers, he wasn't successful. Now, the day of his funeral, my mother came up and she said, "Here's your dad's wallet. His some assets in the world is $11, and the old Chevy that's in the driveway." And never had any plastic, never had a bank account, and he just lived day to day. He always got me what I needed, whether it was a new pair of cleats or a ball glove or whatever. But had no vision beyond tomorrow, the next horse race, the next ball game, the next lucky number to come out.
But he's an interesting character, and so certainly makes an interesting story.
Yeah. Well, the title of the first book, Headstone, is sort of, it doesn't reveal much about the book, because people come back at fairs and stuff and say, you know, is it about gravestones? I said, well, yes and no. It's really not. But I choose that title because when you go to the grave, and I visit my mom and dad, they're buried together, one of the few things they've ever done together, they ever did together. You see two dates, and you have a date when Pamela was born and when they passed. And in between is really the story, not those dates. So I wanted to write about what he meant to the people he knew in his day.
And, you know, as I said, I thought you really captured the essence of the man with the stories about what he did when he was young. I love this story about the statue of, and Tell us about that.
Well, he had a thing where he did when he was little. My father was 5'4", hence the name Junior. And when he was young, I'm sure he hadn't even grown to 5'4". And he was a little character. He was fast as anything. And he delighted in going around and getting the spoiled fruit and vegetables from the pushcart vendor. And he would impale them on General Prescott's sword just off the monument. And it was funny to the people who were tourists coming down from the monument. It was not funny to the guard who chased them all over the monument grass. And I mentioned that in the book, and I don't think he ever caught them.
Well, it's those type of little scenes that I found delightful in your books, just little vignettes of little stories like that that make something come alive. And I really think that was great. It's, again, a very visual thing. It was almost like a movie. You know, I could see it as a scene in a movie because it's so well written. And now you said you started working with a writer's group when you were...
Yeah, I attended one on the Cape where we spent summers, where our permanent residences. And then when I came to Florida, there was a group meeting up in Palm Harbor, and there was a gentleman there who ran the group, a Dr. Rhodes, who's passed away, I believe now. But he was, big help, to me in terms of just encouragement, I think the group you go to has to be a supportive group. When you're just starting out, you don't need criticism.
Yeah.
Even if it's constructive criticism, you need a little bit of help. Now, when you start to write, you need a good editor.
Yeah.
I've been married to a good editor for 46 years, even though this is my first attempt at writing. I did annual reports and things like that.
Yeah.
But, My wife taught school for 36 years, and I think when you independently publish, the first thing you have to have is correct punctuation, correct spelling, correct grammar, and someone's got to check that, because you can't make mistakes. And if you get over that hurdle, then the only other thing you need is a good PR agent, and I think we know I have that.
Well, you have that in your Senate, but you are also very clever yourself. Now, one of the things, of course, writers have to learn, especially today, is that you have to have this platform. You have to be able to get out there after you do the creative work. You have to do the business work, which is why it's important to have your legal rights protected. It's important to set up a Facebook page, all of these things, your platform to get out there and sell. And I found particularly clever one of your methods of changing hats. Tell us about that.
Well,
I think that's such a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I think that, the writing part is obviously the fun part. The difficult part is the marketing of the book. When I first started going to the fairs on the Cape and to bookstores and to libraries, I'll tell you, it's tough. I mean, particularly if you're giving a lecture for 45 minutes, you better have something to say for 44 of those minutes. The marketing can be tough, but after a while, it's sort of a sales line that you come up with, and you try to be as professional and successful as with each person you meet on a one-to-one basis or a group. I think that it's just something you got to work at, to get put to do any sales of the book. And the sales of the book help you write another book. If I get half the money back that it cost me to write the previous book, so I can put it into the next book, so be it.
When you're writing now, your books are small books, very affordable and quick reads, but fun reads. And so books like this that you pick up and you read, and as I said, they add to your knowledge of an area that you didn't know, or they add to your knowledge of a subject you didn't know, are really so much fun. And now when you, what I was mentioning about the hats was when you are down here, what hat did you wear when you go up north? What do you do?
I'm sorry. We live right off the Pinellas Trail, so naturally, when I walk the Pinellas Trail, I try to walk two miles a day or so. I'll wear a Boston Celtics shirt, or I'll wear a Cape Cod shirt, and people are just so friendly. They'll come up and say, you know, oh, what part of the Cape are you from? What part of Boston did you grow up in? That usually lends me to drift eventually into the conversation about the books. I give them my business card, and they either go to the library or buy the book. However, when I'm back in Boston, I'll wear a Florida Gators shirt, and I'll go into the bank, and I'll meet some snowbird, you know, looking at his bank account, and say, gee, what part of Florida did you go to? So, yeah, that trade-off works well.
And then you hand them your business card, and hopefully they'll take a look at your – you have a very nice Facebook page with a lot of very nice photos of all of the events that you attend, which, again, is a very helpful way to get out there and to promote your books. I like that.
I'm a better writer than I am a website designer, I'll tell you right now. My son does a lot of that.
Well, he does a great job because it's very nice.
Yeah.
Now, let's go back a little to your father. Let's talk a little bit more about him because – as I said, he is an interesting character, and it's very touching the way you've written about him. But let's talk about some of his friends and some of the people around him.
Well, when I got to be, you know, in my late teens, one of the places I could find him at was the local gin mill, and he would go there a lot of times, just have something to eat and spend the day. It was like his clubhouse. It was a poor man's country club. And I would go in, and he'd introduce me to his friends. And, it was like Cheers before Cheers in the 60s and 70s. And I remember them distinctly, you know, coming over and talking to me and talking to him. And the humor was just priceless. I mean, it was just something that was totally spontaneous, and everybody would try to get the upper hand, you know, sarcastically on the next guy. And if you went in, you had to be prepared for that, I think, you know. But that was the enjoyment of the whole thing. And I'd go in, I'd sit down and talk to my dad, and he loved to tell jokes. He loved to sing songs. He had this thing where someone would give first two notes of a song, and he had bet that he could tell the song, and he didn't have to go more than a note or so before he could tell what the song was. And they'd wager on that, and usually he always won, you know, with the gentleman in the bar.
Well, my father loved that television show, Name That Tune.
Right.
And because my mother was very good at that.
Yeah.
And so he was the same way? He could...
Yeah, well, he loved music, particularly jazz and the classics and, you know, the American Songbook. He would always listening to my 45 records and say, you know, well, can't you listen to that after I go to sleep?
So when... he liked cars?
Well, he had this love-hate relationship with cars. He would possibly have 10 or... maybe 8 or 10 cars a year. And his philosophy was, as soon as the car needed work, get a new car. Don't do the work on it. So in those days, you could buy another car for $7,500. And that's what he did. You know, he'd switch from car to car. He always had a great radio in the car. You know, I noticed that. I remember that. But, you know, we'd go for rides and, you know, at Christmas time, maybe see the lights in different parts of the city, you know, north of Boston. And in the summertime, we'd go to the beach, you know, Revere Beach and, you know, some of the, you know, local areas that you could get to, you know, in a few minutes. He didn't know much about fixing them, but he sure knew when to trade them.
Now, you know, as you mentioned, I just... This heist that you mentioned in the book, in the end of the first book,
mm-hmm.
It was real?
It was certainly real, and some of the stories I tell from it were real. However, I didn't know those people.
Yeah.
I'll tell you right now. You know, I had heard hearsay, I had newspaper accounts and so forth that I read and I researched even afterwards. I think if you're going to do good fiction, you have to base it on something that took place. It has to be plausible. If it's nonsense, then, you know, people are going to see right through it. I mean, if somebody certainly has done a bank vault burglary, they're going to say, well, you couldn't do it that way. So you like to be as accurate as possible. And I read, you know, a lot of the, you know, law enforcement reports and the newspaper articles and so forth. And I think it was accurate. My father's discussion of it was, you know, pretty much that he had heard this or he had heard that. But, you know, my father was not violent in any way. He was, to my knowledge, he was never arrested even. But as I say, he flew a little under the radar for the times. And those are the times when gambling and alcohol consumption isn't as blessed as it is today. You know.
But he raised a son who turned out to be pretty great, so he must have been pretty great too.
Well, yeah, I was a municipal recreation director for 30 years, and as I say, my dad, he wasn't in the Kiwanis, he wasn't in the Rotary. I can't say that he was, you know, but he was a great dad. And I think one of the things about writing a memoir, and I'd encourage, like you said, everybody to at least start it, you know, start it while the memories are fresh in your mind. Because by doing it, you know, my kids have said, you know, it's like the grandpa's still around the house.
Exactly, you know? Exactly. It's keeping the memories alive, not losing the information. And it's funny, you know, you don't know what historians will make of things long time from now. For example, I'm working on a book that's set in 1875. And one of the things I appreciate the most, and where I find inspiration, are not the history books, not the big books mm-hmm. that were written about the period. It's all of those, and because it's many of the characters are British, and the British were excellent at writing just little books about when they went on a trip. They wrote it all down. And it might be some books are filled just with lists of their shopping, but all of that helps. All of that helps you, you know, to create a full picture of the times. Yeah. And it's so sad when, you know, things are lost and gone forever. And so it's nice that mm-hmm. people do this right, and it's brought a lot of joy to you, I think.
Right. Well, I'm always curious. My son's friends, particularly a lot of the female friends and wives, their wives, will have said to me, "Well, you could smoke in bars," and I'd say, "Well, smoke." I said, "It's like a high mass," and they'd say, "Well, you know, you mentioned in one of the books that people watched a black and white TV that was 15 inches diagonally from the other side of the bar. Could you see anything?" You know, so I think we have to go back and realize that, you know, we didn't have cell phones, you know. We didn't have widescreen TVs. And younger people sometimes aren't aware of that because they didn't live in that time. So I think you capture history by, you know, putting things like that in a book. And I'll tell you, honestly, a lot of it I did just by accident. You know, those were the memories that I had. I didn't do it to reflect on how times have changed. Yeah. But when you document things, that's what you get.
Yeah, they come back to you, yeah. And it is wonderful to do that. And I really admire what you've done. I highly recommend. How can people get your books?
Well, you know, I'm not out to make a fortune. All the books are pretty much in libraries in the Pinellas County or through the exchange. They're on Cape Cod. People who are, you know, from the Boston area can get them when they're down in Cape Cod and some of the libraries on Cape Cod. So they're there. The first book was done by Ex Libris, which is a self-publishing company, and you could get them through them. They are available, I believe, through, you know, that can be bought through Barnes & Noble. You know, uh-huh. they can get the first book, Headstone. The other two books were just done by printers. You know, one, Chase, was done by a local printer in Dunedin who did a terrific job on it, and are in the process of doing a fourth book called Generals.
Mm-hmm. And where do they find them? They can't. They're like in the libraries.
They're in the library.
You're not on Amazon yet.
Yes. Well, they are ebooks. My son is on Amazon. They're an ebook. Ebook. I just assume you get them in the library. I think because
I know the feel of a book.
The feel of the book is great, and you know what the percentage I get is so minute that I just as soon have be happy getting the book out of the library and supporting the library. And a lot of the libraries have gone now to a local author's section. So it's relatively easy to get them accepted. And I don't know, if they're taken out enough, maybe you get to make the big stack.
Okay, well, I recommend to everybody in the area. As a matter of fact, you know, you should go to a library because really libraries are, it's so good for your mind, and it really is a treasure trove for new ideas. So I highly recommend that you go to the local libraries here and get Brian James's books, all of the books. So we have the newest one is Chase. And what's the new one? It's going to be called General?
General's Recalling Age 19. And this is me, and this is totally nonfiction.
Totally nonfiction. Okay, well, we'll look forward to it. And are you going to be at any festivals here in the area?
I did one at the Palm Harbor Library in early January. But down here as a snowbird, I don't really have a lot of the connections to where some of the units are. On the Cape, I usually do a monthly fair, arts and crafts fair.
Okay, well, maybe I can help you next time we have an event around here, a book event. We just had one recently. If I would have known about your book earlier, we could have had you there at the thing selling your book. So I'll make sure that I keep it in mind because I would love to help you get your book. I think it's fantastic that you've done this, and I'm very happy about it. And speaking of Cape Cod, I just want to mention quickly before I say goodbye to that there is going to be in Cape Cod, it's called, it's Andrea Brown's Big Sur Cape Cod Conference, and it's going to be in Cape Cod. It's May 13th through May 19th, and this conference is for children's books. Andrea Brown is the top, absolutely the best literary agent for children's books, and her workshops are so invaluable. You will be absolutely amazed. So anybody who's writing a children's book should think about going to Andrea Brown's Big Sur Cape Cod workshop, and it's available, let me just see, Big Sur Cape Cod. That's it, BigSurCapeCod.com. Go to Big Sur, to that website, BigSurCapeCod.com. Cape Cod's beautiful, right?
Oh, Cape Cod's fantastic in the summer, but you want to be in Dunedin in the winter.
That's it. Well, in May, it's going to be beautiful, and I hope everybody who's writing a kid's book will go to this conference. So this is Patsy with a Z, wishing everyone a great week. I want to thank Brian for coming here today, and to remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them on stage or screen, and Brian knows about that. So join me next Tuesday, and meanwhile, have a great weekend, and don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it, and have a great weekend. Bye.